Today, we're talking with Brian Gaffney, the Chief Experience Officer at Caravalla Coffee. He had a lot to share with us about his journey, from following his curiosity and passion to leaving space for the possibilities that might open new doors. I hope you'll find something here to support you on your journey as Brian shares what he'd tell himself from where he is today. Welcome to I'd Tell Myself, where we dive into the individual journeys people have taken to professional success and share some of the lessons that they've learned along the way. I'm your host, Danielle Frankel. I've long believed that there are many ways to learn the important lessons in life. And while some lessons are only gained through personal experience, others can be learned less painfully from those ahead of us on their own journey. I hope you'll find something here to support you as we ask these individuals what they tell themselves from where they now sit. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. So hey there, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're going to dive in with our standard fast facts. So if you would just share with myself and our listeners your name and a little bit about the work that you do, your job, what leads you here today, that would be great.
Sure. Sounds great. Thank you. Hello, friends. My name is Brian Gaffney. I live in Brooklyn, New York with my wife, Kim, and two boys, James and John. I am originally from Atlanta, Georgia, but I've been in New York now for over 25 years, so this really does feel like home. In addition to being a professional that we'll get into a little bit, I am a deep lover of jazz music, of photography, of outdoor cooking, grilling specifically, and of finding the balances in life that come between living in an urban space like Brooklyn and wanting to get to upstate New York, where we can trade a little asphalt and concrete for some grass and some soil.
Nice. And what do you do for work?
For work, I am, as of about 19 days, I am the new Chief Experience Officer for Caravalla Coffee. And Caravalla is a green coffee exporter and importer that is technically based in London, but our base of operations is in Colombia. And our responsibility is to source some of the finest green coffee from Latin America, make sure that we respect and protect the quality that those producers work to deliver, and then we make that coffee available to roasters around the world.
And for anybody who might not know, what is a chief experience officer? What does that mean?
The one sentence description that we have come up with is, my role is to ensure that our practices for sourcing coffee from coffee producers, our processes of sourcing that coffee, milling that coffee, processing that coffee, getting that coffee ready to ship, and then ultimately the process of selling that coffee to coffee roasters is as easy and is as efficient and user-friendly as possible. Our job is to make the business of buying coffee enjoyable where we can, but even where it can't necessarily be enjoyable, we want to make sure that it has transparency, traceability, its personality. And as opposed to thinking about buying a commodity, the idea is that we are partnering coffee roasters around the world with coffee producers. So that relationship is what we're helping to facilitate, as opposed to simply the provision of a good from one stakeholder to another.
That's so cool. Not much of a transaction as a real relationship.
Without a doubt. And for us, that really is the way that we think of ourselves, less of being coffee traders and more of being coffee matchmakers. The idea of from whom the coffee came, the kind of coffee it is itself, the process by which that coffee was grown, a lot of it has to do with the practices and the craft of that particular producer. And so that is what we want to focus on so that the end consumer of our customer's customer really starts to think more about what's in my cup, right? What am I drinking? And thinking a little bit more about who am I drinking? So the same way we might think about when we're sitting down and having a wonderful glass of wine and we're thinking about the vineyard and the winemaker, we want to invite that person enjoying that cup of coffee to have those same thoughts and feelings about the cup of coffee they're drinking.
Oh, that's great. I know that this is a newer role for you, but I understand that you have been deeply engaged with coffee for a long time. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got here? Did you always envision that your career aspirations were to be a coffee matchmaker?
Absolutely not, is the answer to that question, Danielle. My relationship with coffee really began sitting around my grandmother's table. And this is my paternal grandmother, Edna Gaffney, Edna Brown Gaffney in South Carolina. And at this point, I'm 4 years old, maybe 5 years old, going to visit. And at this point, it's instant coffee. And what's in my cup is actually more condensed milk than it is coffee. But it's sitting around the table with my grandmother. And so it's having that moment. And so that's important because the imprint of social connection with coffee for me began very early. I was not a very big coffee drinker in my teen years, even in college or even in my early 20s. When my now wife and I were dating, we would go to a diner or we would go out to brunch. We would both order coffee and I would slide my Dyna mug across to her and she would make my coffee the same way she made hers, right? Which is milk, two sugars, kind of classic New York coffee. But it wasn't until probably about 2006, 2007, and there's a little French place that opened around the corner from us here in Brooklyn. It's called Choice. And Raphael was the barista at that point. And I'd been going in since they'd opened, and I go in and the same thing, Raphael would hand me the cup of coffee. I would add the half and the sugar. And after going for several months, Raphael said to me one day, he said, Brian, every day you come in and you buy the coffee and you add the milk and the sugar. I said, but you never just taste the coffee. So do me a favor, just taste the coffee. And then if you want to add milk or sugar, feel free to do so. But then you know what you're adding it to and to what effect you're adding it. So the same thing when you try your food, you don't just sit down and season with salt and pepper first. You taste it and then you add. And that invitation by Raphael was the beginning of what has become a personal passion that's then transformed into a professional opportunity. So doing that, and then at that point, they roasted Intelligentsia Coffee. They're a coffee roaster based in Chicago, and they had a training lab here in New York City. And you could go to the training lab as anyone off of the street and taste different coffees from different countries. And so this was the beginning of really me beginning to think about coffee as a culinary product, as opposed to simply a delivery mechanism for caffeine. And so all of a sudden, coffees from East Africa taste different from coffees from Central America. Coffees from Central America will taste different from coffees from South America. And then if you throw Vietnam in as well, you start to really begin to appreciate the nuances, and mind blown. And that was really the beginning for me. And so from that point to making my first trip to Coffee Origin in Costa Rica in 2015, my first trip to Colombia in 2016 was really about me wanting to understand and learn more about this thing that we call a bean, which is really the seed of a fruit. Coffee grows on a tree, and most cherries that grow on the coffee tree have two seeds inside. And those seeds, when you let the cherry ripen, you squeeze the seeds and you wash off the mucilage through a process and you let that dry. And those become the coffee beans that we buy and sell as green. Coffee roasters buy those green beans and roast those. And then they become the brown beans that either we know is whole bean or that we buy ground, and we get that beautiful brown powder that we like to brew in the mornings. And as I learned more about coffee through several lenses of it, through politically, socioeconomically, anthropologically, the story of coffee is just fascinating. And I just couldn't get a hold of it. And so I couldn't, it took hold of me and I couldn't let it go. And I read lots of books and lots of articles and watched lots of videos and visited many cafes, and then got to a point where I realized if I want to keep learning more, I'm really going to have to start building relationships. There's only so much that I can do and learn in and of myself. And that was what initially prompted the origin trips. And then probably about 6 years ago now, there's one of the coffee roasters that who I respect and appreciate the coffees quite a bit, actually based out of Acton, Massachusetts, George Howell. Met George Howell at a coffee event in New York and asked him a question about where he sourced his coffees, his Colombian coffees in particular. He mentioned Caravela coffee to me. I said, okay, great. And being a management consultant by training, the understanding processes and who's involved, the stakeholders, what their role is in getting underneath was a bit natural for me at that point. And so I wanted to go and develop the relationships with Caravela, which then led to me reaching out to one of their co-founders and the CEO and reaching out saying, hey, I know that I'm not your traditional mentee, but if you're open to mentorship, I'd love to learn more about the industry from the origin side from you. And to that relationship, I can bring the things that are important to me as a consumer. And through that conversation had evolved into a friendship that's been an exchange over time, and ultimately that's borne the fruit of the invitation to join Caravela as their chief experience officer. Again, that's starting as of January 1st of this year, 2024.
That's so cool. I love how you just really, it's a slow unfolding of following your interests and following your passions and making interesting requests that a lot of people, I think we often stop short because we're nervous or anxious or don't feel comfortable reaching out to say, hey, you're an expert. Will you teach me this thing that is your area of expertise? I'd love to know about it. It's wonderful. And it sounds like you guys have evolved your relationship beautifully. It's been beneficial to everybody.
Thank you very much. And we have, and here's where I really have to give my wife a lot of credit. Because prior to bringing Kim into the conversation, and thankfully, my wife loves a good cup of coffee. So she has absolutely been an enabler in this process. But even as I was looking to deepen my knowledge and my experience and my education, her point was, listen, stop trying to go and become an expert at something before you reach out to someone. So listen, if you have an awareness, then reach out to someone and ask that question. Be curious about them, share with them what you want to learn. Her point was people want to be part of your success. People want to be part of your journey. And so if you invite people in to do that, then there's a little bit of an exchange in there as well, that yes, you learn what they're willing to share, but they also have an opportunity to help you develop and to grow. Danielle, that was a big thing for me that didn't come naturally. I was really quite the opposite until the prodding of Kim to encourage me to do that. And so now with that shift in perception and that mindset, it really freed me up to say, okay, I don't need to read all of your books or all of your articles or watch all of your videos, right? You always want to have a really good understanding of what someone does and what they're about, but then just reach out and say, hey, can we start a conversation, right? Can we start a discussion? And it freed me up from needing to have all of the answers. It freed that person up to really then understand how they might be able to share something with me that I didn't know. I no longer felt the need to prove that I'm smart enough to be in the room, but it's just through the connection. And by being curious, by being willing to engage, by being vulnerable, not just in the relationship with Alejandro, but I think in my overall professional journey, as I have, and I say that because Kim and I have been together for almost 25 years, so we've been together for a while. She's been a formative part of my development. And that was something on which we worked early on. And so as I have adopted that, I have found that to be really helpful in my journey, right? Being willing to ask really good questions, as opposed to being focused on having the right answer, has been super helpful in accelerating fulfillment. And I think even fulfillment, but even as new opportunities come about, raising your hand and saying, hey, I think that's something I'd be interested in, putting my hat in the ring, volunteering to do something that I may not fully know how to do yet. But by being curious and just being willing to engage and being vulnerable, I think it's one of the best things you can do to help facilitate your own growth.
I couldn't agree more. And I love the distinction. It's a different ask, right? It's a whole different engagement when you show up to somebody to say, would you share something with me, versus showing up to an expert to validate that you already know enough. It's an entirely different, obviously, it's an entirely different request for all parties involved, but it's also an entirely different experience. And the possibilities are very different in those two scenarios. Right?
100%.
You're seriously limiting the possibilities if you're showing up for validation. Whereas if you're showing up for learning and building, that's something that you can do together and all the doors are open.
100%. It's showing up, recognizing that, oh, I know what I don't know. And then really what you're asking someone to do is help fill in the gaps, versus showing up saying, hey, I don't know what I don't know, and I'm open. And those are, to your point, fundamentally different asks, which lead to fundamentally different paths. Because if you go in thinking, I know what I don't know, and I just want to fill in those blanks, then there's this kind of a predetermined path that you can then travel what you know. But if you go and say, I'm really not sure, this is what I know at the moment, this is what I'm curious about, then all of a sudden you can begin co-creating a future together. And I think as is indicated by this role, that Caravella did not have a chief experience officer before, but it was really through an understanding of where they are in the company's almost 25-year history, where they want to go, what I'm interested in doing in my professional life, where I want to go, sharing a little bit of that imagination together, and then being able to say, there really is something that we think we can do together, and then co-creating that role, which is something that I think if you'd asked them 5 years ago, did they need one? If you'd asked me 5 years ago, or even 2 years ago, we both probably would have said no. I think even as I thought about pivoting from the career that I'm leaving as I'm joining Caravella, could I have ever foreseen that something like this would happen? No. But I showed up, was willing to have the conversation, acknowledged that I don't know what I don't know. And it just leaves so much room for possibility.
It does. It's such a great highlight of literally why I'm having these conversations in the first place, right? Because your story makes perfect sense in hindsight. I totally get how you began this exploration and you got more curious and you did some things on your own and it led to this relationship. And over time, this relationship led to this new possibility. Makes perfect sense in hindsight. You could not have planned it no matter how hard you tried. Like it is impossible to script. So thank you for that. It is exactly why, a big piece of why I'm having these conversations. But to that end, let's go back a little bit because, like we said, this is not the career that you've been at since you began working adult jobs. And you didn't envision yourself being a coffee matchmaker as a child. Let's go back and tell me a little bit about what the types of work that you've done. And even further, what did you think you wanted to do when you grew up? What has the rest of this journey looked like to get you here?
Sure. And it really has been a varied journey. I even appreciate you saying it all makes perfect sense looking in hindsight. And that really is about the construction of a narrative. Because if you look at it from looking forward, it probably looks far more like chutes and ladders than it does a straight line. But when I think about youngest Brian and the earliest thing I ever remember wanting to be, it was to be a photographer for National Geographic. That was the thing. I never wanted to be a policeman or a fireman or even like a medical doctor. There was a time a little bit later I thought about law, but earliest Brian wanted to be a photographer for National Geographic. And I think that spoke to two things. It's one, the love of photography, which in some ways continues through today. My very first camera to even date and age myself a little bit was a Kodak Instamatic 126 camera. Like it was the one where you had to literally buy the flash cube that's set on top of the camera and you got four exposures and then you had to buy a new flash cube. That was my earliest camera. It was photography, which is the idea of capturing moments. And I think it was the idea of travel, which is what National Geographic did through those pages. You just saw so much of the world. And then as I made my way into school, I loved the sciences. I think really my passion for the sciences began that I can recall really in seventh grade. That's when I cared a lot about the presentation of my notebook. Mr. Mathis, who was my science teacher at this point, this is Camp Creek Middle School, but we would get an additional grade for the neatness of our notebooks, right? How well we'd taken the notes. And that's when we started working on in-class science projects. And so the idea to ask a question, right? My introduction to the scientific method, come up with a hypothesis, have to do the research, build your experiment. And that continued in science was my primary area of academic interest up to and through high school. In high school, I competed in science fairs. I took all of the AP courses. What was really cool is actually my senior year of high school, I actually had my research supported by a swimming pool chemical company because I was working on whether or not the bacteria found in swimming pools could easily adapt to inorganic chlorine. Again, I truly geeked out. I've always been a gay, right? I'm not particularly T-shaped. I don't particularly go broad, but I tend to go super deep in topics. And then I remember learning, I think this was also senior year, where researchers had taken one of the genes from a lightning bug, and they transplanted that into a tobacco plant so that when a tobacco plant was infected with a particular fungus, it would glow. And so the idea of transplanting bioluminescence from an insect to a plant, I was like, that was super exciting. So I thought leaving high school that I was on my way to the PhD route. Molecular genetics was the way I thought I was going. Left high school, had a fellowship from the National Science Foundation, went to Morehouse College in Atlanta. And the beginning of my sophomore year had an existential academic crisis because I fell out of love with the lab. And so now this is going back to, as I mentioned, so from seventh grade, right now, through freshman year of college, science has been the way I've leaned. And all of a sudden, and science, and then specifically within the lab, and I'm falling out of love with the lab. And a little footnote here is that in the course that I was taking when I fell out of love was plant sciences. And I enjoy the irony there, given my interest in coffee and how literally it brings me back to the plants. But I remember that was freshman year. And so I remember I did two things. I finished the first semester. I went to the National Science Foundation office and I forfeited my fellowship. And so this is the end of first semester. So this is probably November. And then I called my parents and told them that I'd done it. Because I knew that if I'd asked permission to do that, that they would say no, and then that it would have been a very different decision, right? Now, but if I did it and then let them know after the fact, but it was a difficult moment for me personally, even for the family. I stayed home. I didn't go home for Thanksgiving. that year I stayed on campus because we were working through all that meant. Because in many, my not only was my education covered, but there was a stipend that I was being paid. So it was really going to shift the financial reality of my college education. Thankfully, we worked through that. And I spent a semester as a psychology major. And I thought that was interesting. But I said, if I do that, I'll immediately have to go to grad school. And I don't know that I want to do that. But as I was falling out of love with science, I was falling in love with jazz and the music. One of the gifts about being a college student in Atlanta at that time is that Clark Atlanta University had a jazz radio station, WCLK 91.9. And I would tend to stay up late. I was, as many college students do, but I would stay up late and I would do all of my papers, all of my studying late at night with WCLK playing, and really began just learning about the musicians, the different band compositions, right? For example, Miles Davis has really two great quintets of his career. And again, almost looking at the way the musicians and the way that the musicians play in this taxonomy, the same way that I thought about the sciences, just understanding how the different members of the band play with other members of the band. And that's the way I started to curate my music collection. So I spent that semester as a psychology major, didn't quite do that. And so I said, now that I'm falling in love with jazz, and I think that music is the direction in which I want to go, what will get me to New York? And that was really the question. And what will get me out of school in 4.5 years? Because 1996 was the year that I was supposed to graduate. I knew that by making the shift, I was going to cost myself some time, but I made a commitment to myself. I was only going to spend an additional semester. I was supposed to finish in 96. So instead of spring, I was going to make it fall. So I looked at marketing, the kinds of companies with whom I could interview, and started that. And then with several overloaded semesters, but I finished school in 4.5 years with a degree in marketing. And at that point, an offer from formerly Coopers & Lybrand, which then later became PwC, which will be a little bit fun later because I ended up joining PwC later in my career. And I also received an offer from American Express. And American Express then, as is now, was known as one of the preeminent direct marketing organizations in the country. And so I accepted the offer from Amex. They were going to move me to New York, which is where I wanted to be. I was going to be able to spend time in the jazz clubs, get to know the musicians, et cetera. So thankfully, that all worked out. I came to New York. I spent about just shy of 2 years in American Express and went from American Express to HBO to Warner Music. And there I'd done it. I'd landed in music. And it was an interesting time to join because I think the time that I joined Warner, which is right at about 2000, the music industry was really changing. I think by the time I joined, Warner had just completed its distribution deal with iTunes. So now the idea of music moving from physical product to digital product, and now music as a technology was really beginning to emerge, which was interesting professionally, but started really to chip a little bit away at my love affair with the idea of working in music and what I thought that meant. At the same time, it was one of those formidable professional experiences. Bob Bunshaft was the person who hired me into Warner to work with him on our business development team. And my role within Warner was we worked as part consultancy, part incubator for the labels that fell within Warner Music Group. So as we were thinking about launching ringtones, so we launched the ability to develop ringtones. We launched that capability within our group, and then we made that available to the labels. So we did that with ringtones. We did that with one of the first CRM systems in the music industry. We worked on it. We built, well, there was some third-party software that we licensed from a company in Canada, put that together, built it. We built it out and made that available so that now the labels could not only send emails to a particular artist's fans, but then also as we people subscribe to those lists and we can then look at like interests of this artist's fans like this artist, let's start to leverage that, right? Things that are simple today, we were just really beginning to build those things out, but those are the kinds of things we did. And so for me, that was the beginning of really working from a perspective of problem solving within a particular context. And that's what I loved. But I mentioned Bob in particular because I remember one of the challenges that Bob made, which again, now may seem super simple, but Bob said, okay, Brian, we built out the system. We need a user's manual, and I want you to do it. And I'm thinking to myself, I've never written a technical user manual in my life. I barely even read them. And I remember Bob and I having a conversation in his office, said, Bob, I have no idea how to do this. And he said something to the effect of, that's okay. I know. but I also know you'll figure it out. And Daniel, I bring that up because it's one of those things where when you have someone who believes in you and is willing to support and invest in you, say, listen, even though you're not sure you can do it, even though you don't think you can, I think you can. And whatever you need, ask. And so thankfully we got it written. I found a couple of books. Amazon at that point was available. I remember there was it was the User Manual Guide to Writing User Manuals. I'm pretty sure that was the name of the book that I ended up buying. But so bought the book and started doing the work. And it's actually in my 25 plus year career, it's one of the things, and actually, no, my career is longer than that. Actually, I take that back. Career is probably closer to now 27, 28 year career. Writing that user manual is one of the things about which I'm most proud, because it's one of the things I remember starting with. I have no idea how to do this, figured it out, and it became an incredibly helpful resource. So that was the beginning at Warner. I stayed at Warner Music for 5 years. Until really it was time to go. The music industry had changed. The ownership of the music group has changed. I was like, okay, it's time for a different challenge. And so ended up leaving there, did some independent consulting, because again, I had that taste of, it's that scientific method, right? Kind of identifying the problem, coming up with a hypothesis, doing that in a business context. And I wanted to be able to do more of that. But consulting independently was tough at that point. Trying to have our firstborn, our oldest son was born. So trying to be a good husband, a good father, taking time for myself while also finding clients, doing work, selling work. That was a challenge. And so I started looking to do things externally. But at the same time, I also said, it's probably a good time to go back to grad school. Now, I'd studied marketing. So I'd studied business in undergrad, and I didn't necessarily want to do an MBA. But around this time, the idea of design thinking was really beginning to emerge. So a lot of the work out of Stanford Design School, Stanford D School, was really, and people were beginning to talk about the need to work on not simply convergent, but divergent thinking, right? The ability to really have a human-centered approach to design. These kind of things were coming to the fore. And so the School of Visual Arts here in New York City, Debbie Millman is one of the founding chairperson. So they had their first graduate degree in branding. I say, I think that's the thing I would like to do, because in the past, I'd worked with technologists, I'd worked with financial analysts, I'd worked with different kinds of people, but I'd never worked shoulder to shoulder with designers. And I just had to think that's the way that the world is going. And I remember finishing the application, again, because it was here in New York. I remember on the last day, my wife and I are driving into the city so that I can drop off my application. And I remember thinking, I'm being proud of myself just at the achievement of just getting that done. Because it was not only applying to a program, but really applying to a program where I felt like I really didn't fit. Like I was going to be the business guy in the room full of designers. Whereas many of my peers and my classmates at that time, they were designers who were looking to learn more about the business world. And I'm excited to say I didn't get accepted. So I got the thank you for applying. We appreciate it, all that we learned about you, but you're waitlisted. So I was absolutely disappointed. And then I think my cell phone rang probably a week before the program was to begin. And Debbie Millman called me and said, hi, Brian, this is Debbie Millman, right? Chairperson of the Master Professional Studies and Branding Program at SVA. Would you still like to attend? I was the first person on the wait list. And so it was a class of 23. Unfortunately, one of the folks who originally was admitted chose not to attend, but that created a slot for me. And I bring that up because, and so fast forward, it was a year-long program, and I was one of two to graduate with honors. And at this point, so as I'm starting school, our second child is 6 weeks old. So again, going back to the importance of partnership in life. So I now have a wife who has a two-year-old and a six-week-old and says, you're going to be in school 5 to 6 nights a week plus working. I'm willing to support you. Just make it count. And I did. My goal was to, my KPI was to get my questions asked down to a cost of about 5 cents each. So I went in hungry. And I went in hungry because I knew that the sacrifices that were being made at home for me to be able to be here and develop some wonderful friendships that are still very close to me and dear to me to this day as I went through that program. And then coming out of the program, as I mentioned, so I know that I love consulting. I now have some of this experience working with designers. And then I learned about PwC, or at that point, and they had what was then a group called Customer Impact Consulting. And in all of my career, from American Express to HBO to Warner Music, I lived in service to the end customer. So it sounded like a great place to fit in. My wife at the time worked at the firm, which is, and so she introduced me to the group, had a fantastic set of interviews with leaders, some of whom are still at the firm, and again, who are willing to invest in me and say, okay, here's a guy who non-traditional consulting background, seems smart, seems like he gets it. Sure, welcome to the team. And went in, and this is one of those where I went in interviewing for a manager position. But based on my experience, right, I hadn't necessarily worked with a lot of formal frameworks, even in the independent consulting that I had done. So the methodology that the larger firms use, I'd never used before. And this is another one of those times where I wanted to go in as a manager and they say, hey, we want to make you an offer, but we want to bring you in as a senior associate. And so for those who may not know that the consulting structure, the senior associate is one band below manager. And that was a bit of an ego check initially, right? Because I'm thinking, I can do the work. But I'll never forget, it was John Swaidner, who was then a director, very soon after became a partner. He said, Brian, use this year to build your firm IQ. And again, that's one of those nuggets of wisdom that will stay with me forever. He said, because if we coming in as a manager, your responsibilities are going to be different than if you come in as a senior. So take this time and learn so that when you hit that manager route, you can really hit that and jump and accelerate. And so it's that humility. It's trusting that as people come across your path and being invested in you doesn't mean that they say yes to everything that you want them to say yes to. But it's really being open that if they're invested in you, it's being quiet and still and patient enough to hear that perspective and say, ooh, I don't necessarily like that, but maybe that's the right thing for me. And it was the right thing for me. It gave me a chance to learn how the firm works. And it's a big firm with a lot of very complex processes and systems that you have to learn to navigate separate and apart from getting the work done. And so spent 11 years at PwC building my competency around structured problem solving, right? Kind of how, you know, basic core consulting skills, communication skills, client engagement, client services. I'll never forget one of my favorite clients, and this is fairly early in my career. He just purchased his first Mercedes-Benz. And so when he wanted to have conversations that he didn't necessarily want to have in the office, we'd go to the dealership. He'd ask me to ride with him to the dealership. And we'd sit in the dealership while the car's being washed and the oil's being checked. And that's where he and I would have these conversations. And so understanding that those are the kinds of relationships that you can build professionally, that's where I learned that it can be work-based, but it doesn't always have to happen in a conference room, right? Or it doesn't have to happen in an office. And so spent 11 years learning that I loved problem solving. And then I think, like many consultants, we step into the business because we do solving problems and different kinds of problems. And then sometimes it's solving similar problems, but for different clients. So the context can be different. I think many of us get to the point where we're like, I like the way that this works, but is there a specific area where I'd really like to focus on problem solving, where I'd really like to double down? And for me, so again, so my career at PwC went from 2012 to 2020, right, wrapping up in 2022, but I was developing this love for coffee. And I was, in many ways, I was looking at the specialty coffee industry and I was trying to treat the industry like a client. And so during that time, as a coffee lover and someone who's interested in it, I'd written a couple of articles, I'd done a little bit of work, I'd volunteered at industry conferences in the US and abroad to build those relationships, to learn what I didn't know, to find out, is there space in this industry where I can really contribute? Or should I just keep buying a cup of coffee, right? From my favorite roaster, my favorite cafe. And again, so about 5 years ago, 7 years ago, is I think when it started with Alejandro, building this relationship, having conversations. One of the benefits of PwC when you make director is you're offered a sabbatical. So I spent 4.5 weeks in Colombia the summer of 2022. And that was a fantastic experience where over the course of that 4.5 weeks, from days spent on the farm, literally picking coffee cherries off of the tree, to spending time learning to wet mill coffee, which is part of the process of squeezing the seeds out of the fruit, letting it dry, going to the dry mill, which is you have to assess it for quality, sort defects, just make sure that ultimately you're starting with a really good green coffee that's going to be, it's going to wet roast well, preparing that coffee to then ship to customers around the world. So I saw all of it in that 4.5 weeks. And the goal after that 4.5 weeks was, I'm either going to finally, okay, I've seen enough and I now feel, okay, I'm now a really well-informed coffee consumer. And I'm good now with that knowledge and experience. I'm ready to keep going. Or I'm going to go have that experience. And that's literally, as opposed to it being enough, that's going to be the point. And I'm really ready to double down. And it's the latter that happened after that sabbatical experience. I was really ready to double down. And the question would just be, where and what is the right opportunity? And through conversations that happened over time, through any conversations with formal and informal mentors and sponsors and leaders and people who know me there. It's funny, one of my oldest son's friends, this is just before the pandemic. I remember he came by the house, and I think he came by the house. The kids might've been out of school and I was on a work call. And I remember he said to me, "Mr. Brian, you don't work in coffee?" So I always thought that you worked in coffee because that love. So what I recognized, and even going back to, 2018, 2019, 2020, my personal brand was so committed to coffee. And I think at that point, it's just a matter of sometimes, but you have to wait until the opportunity is right. There were things I applied for and put my hat out there to do certain things in coffee, but clearly those weren't the right experiences. And so as I stand here now, as we've played chutes and ladders, that's how I've arrived at this place that never could I have imagined that this is where I would have landed, even if you'd asked me that 3 years ago, Danielle. But to remain open, to know what it is that you really like about what you like, how you want to work, the kinds of people with whom you want to work. And you're clear about that with yourself. You have that self-awareness. You can share that in your conversations. You can share your aspirations with folks. And then in those conversations, you can create something, is how I've arrived at this place of Chief Experience Officer.
It's amazing. It's, you say snakes and ladders, right? I love all the different twists and turns. And like you said, you don't take a T-shaped interest to things, right? When you love something, you go all in and like you become the expert in the thing until you figure out until you figure out if you're going to just continue to love it or if you're going to have it become a part of you have you become a part of it instead of it just becoming a part of you.
Right.
But it's also interesting to see some of the trails that clearly have supported you all along, right? The love that you had of the scientific method, right? And the way that clearly, realistically, right? That clearly also supports some of the approaches that we take in the consulting world and the whole way that you approached learning about this, right? You had a whole lot of information to gather, right? Before you even got to the point where you tested out your hypothesis about whether this was, again, going to be your business thing or just a love thing. That's terrific. You shared some really lovely stories about people who gave you opportunities or who supported you. There are a few questions that I like to make sure that I check in with people about. So I just want to offer one other opportunity around that, which is I find it fascinating the times when people show up unexpectedly and that they are unexpectedly kind and the way that sometimes opens new doors, either because of how they have been kind or simply because they have, and it is so unexpected to receive it. I wonder if there are any other stories about that you'd like to share with us.
Thank you for asking. And there is, and it gives me an opportunity to give a shout out to Jose Reyes. So Jose Reyes was the chief creative officer for PwC until he left. But I remember, consulting is all about being utilized, right? It's, and again, for those who aren't familiar with the model, you work for a consulting firm, but ultimately the firm sells work and that work needs to be staffed. And ultimately the firm makes money as clients pay for the staffing of those teams and those professional services. And so part of the assessment of every consultant's performance is based on their utilization. And so as the firm sells work, you need to be staffed on that work. So that, you're being utilized and therefore you're a profitable participant. And my utilization was low and I was not being picked up. And I'll never forget, I got a phone call it wasn't a phone call. I take that back. It was an instant message. It was a ping. And he kind of said, "Hey, Gaffney, what's up?" And he said, "Hey, man, I've been looking at you. Your utilization is low. Dude, I know you're great. What's going on?" And so we then took that and then ended up having a conversation. Shared with him a little bit about what I wanted to do, what my interests were. He said, "Dude, I think I've got a great opportunity for you." And so at that point ended up inviting me to participate in what was then PwC was working to commercialize part of its innovation process so that some of this was a bit more predictable and time bound, right? Oftentimes we think about innovation, it feels very loose, it feels very free, which can sometimes be a challenge if there are certain business metrics that you want to be able to make. So how can we accelerate that innovation process, which then helps clients to commercialize those opportunities much faster? And so we had a particular solution that helped to do that. And so the person who was responsible for that, so that solution leader, was leaving, and Jose invited me in. And to your point, Danielle, about kindness, it was Jose recognizing, hey, I know this guy, his utilization is low. Let me just reach out. Let me have a conversation with him. Let me find out what's going on. And then how can I, which is the question I imagine that Jose asked, how can I support him in his ongoing development? And that was that supreme kindness. It's a great example of that. And our friendship continues. Our friendship continued after he left the firm. And it continued even after I shared with him that I'd left. And he was so excited that I found this opportunity to do something I love. And in a way, even in this world of the chief experience officer, what we were doing around experience, and we were doing both a kind of product and service innovation within that particular solution, really that time that Jose invited me in and the 2 years that I spent within that particular team really helped to prepare me for this chief experience officer where I'm sitting now. It would have been much more difficult if I'd stepped from my traditional sector consulting into this space. So even it's the willingness to be seen, the willingness to reach out, the willingness to have the conversation, and then the investment. And again, so that's one of, when I think about kindnesses, Jose Reyes, absolutely 100% is the person that I want to make sure gets that shout out and recognizes. And I want to make sure he receives the recognition for his investment in my career.
That's great. It's an interesting theme, right? You've shared a couple of these stories with us, and it seems, as I sort of look at the notes that I've taken as we're having this chat, the opportunities that people, the places where people offered you these kindnesses, right? Opportunities where they knew that something more was possible for you, right? It's a common theme, at least across the stories that you've shared, which is such a kind and generous thing for, you know, it's a kind and generous way for people to show up in our lives.
100%, especially when very often, when we're in the busyness of life, we can see a certain trajectory, right? We can see a certain distance out. And sometimes when life gets busy, that visibility gets reduced. And so it often takes those who are around you, who know the context and know you well enough, and they have a different perspective. So they may be able to see ahead of a turn that you can't quite see, or they may be able to, just because of where they sit, they can see some things that you're not able to see. And when you talk about what's possible, more being possible, it helps to have two things. I think it helps to have folks in your life who have that perspective. And then it also motivates me to be that person in other people's lives, right? Like these kindnesses that have been paid to me, it's also incumbent upon me to be able to pay those forward as well. Is that I want to be able to support others in that. I want to be able to provide that perspective to others so that the experiences that I'm having, ideally, and as you have these conversations with professionals across the board, we start hearing and seeing more of these stories instead of thinking of them as anomalies, because I think they're probably more common than we think. And so, yeah, just super excited to be able to share a little bit of my story here with you and your listeners.
Yeah, thank you. I love that you raised the idea of perspective, because I look at that a lot in the work that I do. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think that we tend to get very locked into, especially when we're in moments of stress or working really for a long period of time in a very concrete way, we tend to get really locked into these sort of more closed perspectives. And having people in our lives who are able to, either because of where they sit professionally or because they're coming at it from a different angle, right, take a step out and see a bigger picture and then help bring us into that, right? Sometimes kindness is not even about what people do for you, right? It's not even opportunities that they invite you into or create. It's simply the ability to help you see something differently, right? That perspective, being able to shift perspectives and having people who can help you do that, I think is a gift in and of itself.
100%. And I think as we work on the relationships in our lives to make sure that we invite people to play that role, right? Again, this is another thing. We have to create an opportunity to build that with folks so that people feel comfortable sharing that with us, so that we are comfortable to be vulnerable in that way. So I think and as we do it and we look around and say, hey, you know, do I have people who feel comfortable doing that with me or for me? And if so, that's great. And how am I investing there? And if not, what are the kinds of things that I can do to create, to open that door a little bit wider than it might be today, so that people do feel comfortable, right, helping me, you know, encouraging me sometimes comfortably and sometimes uncomfortably, right? But shifting that perspective in that position, because if not, we lose out on the gift that perspective can provide.
That's right. That's right. So shifting perspectives a little bit, I find that one of the other aspects to this, and they are often tied together, they certainly have been in my experience, but one of the other aspects that I love to dig into a bit is mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. And when you've got these sort of fabulous winding or snakes and ladder style journeys, like you're saying, we all have these moments that we look back on where we wish the ground had just opened up and swallowed us whole, but it didn't. And so we had to fix it or apologize or clean it up or find a way to move forward and learn something useful from it. And I'm curious, across your career, are there moments that you can point to where a huge mistake, where you made a huge mistake, but where maybe you were able to turn it into something useful as well?
Sure. I think as I look at overall, and I think what's interesting for me in being, you know, fully transparent, I think it's something that I have to be careful for both in my personal and my professional life. It's, Brian, don't overstay your welcome. I know that even as I think about my professional journey, there are probably, and not probably, I know that there are some roles and some organizations that I should have left sooner than I did. And a lot of that was driven by, and quite frankly, fear. It was fear of change. It was fear of, okay, I have to go somewhere and learn a different organization and a different people and a different culture. And so that is the thing. And so when you overstay your welcome, then lots of things can become mistakes, because you're now, when be it the level at which you should be performing or being able to really apply your gifts and your talents and the skills that you've worked to build, the souring of relationships, all those things will have negative impact. And not only will they have negative impact, again, if we're talking professionally on the work product and work outcome, but it's also in self-esteem and self-confidence and the sense of self-worth. And so you begin to doubt and question yourself. And so I would say that as I've looked, there have been times where I've stayed in a place too long because it was comfortable. And there have been times when I've said, okay, really, I've been here too long. I have to make the leap. And there have been times when people have said to me, okay, Brian, thank you for your service and your time with us. And we're now going to invite you to jump, right? But either way, Danielle, you know what I've learned? Is either way, you have to jump. And so what I have really committed to practicing in personally and professionally is, when a season is over, jump. And because either whether it's going to be a push or you're going to hop, but jump, because the next opportunity, right, which is going to be right, even if it's right for what's next, right? Being right doesn't mean it's going to be the next permanent thing or the next forever thing. But and to recognize that seasonality. And so that's what I think about is, and it's being really clear with, okay, so what does a season mean? And one of the things that I'm really excited about that we're doing at Caravella is we've introduced OKRs, the idea of OKRs in assessing kind of individual goals and responsibilities. So instead of just business KPIs or kind of an individual, okay, these are your goals, but for this quarter or for this 6 months, what are your objectives? What are the key results you want to achieve? And what are the initiatives that you're going to work on? And what this process, and it's just a more human process that allows you to understand that one, that the definition of success is going to change over time, and that you may have to pivot even as you're going through. If you're looking at what you want to accomplish in Q2 of 24 and you realize a month in, something's going to hold you up. Let's pivot now that you're 1 month in, instead of waiting until we get to the end of Q2 and then realizing, oh, right, things didn't get delivered. And so things like OKRs, where it is really having a sense for, in this particular season of marriage, of parenting, of work, of diet and exercise, but just what does this season look like in my friendships? What season are we in right now? And as a result of knowing that season, and what are the needs of this season? And making sure that I'm attentive to that. And if I can be attentive to that, then sure, I'll still make mistakes, but I'll likely make fewer, bigger ones. And I'll recognize that when a season is ending and something new is needed, I'll be able to be responsive to that, right? Actively responsive to that, so that we can keep bearing fruit, right, in these relationships, again, whether they're personal or professional.
Yeah, that's great. It's interesting. Part of what I'm hearing in what you're laying out there, at least in the work context, also is an approach to management and leadership, which is part of the space that I work in. And I always love to ask people. So I operate off the premise that we manage work and we lead people. And from the moment that you are in a position of management where there are other people who are accountable to you, you are automatically in a position of leadership where there's the opportunity to learn and grow and also potentially to do damage. So I always love to ask people, how did you learn? How did you learn what you know? Whatever your current approach is to being in a leadership position, right? And you're stepping in to this new business, for new to you business, right? But you're doing it in an executive position. As you said, you joined PwC as a senior associate, but you worked your way up to director, right? You managed large teams. How did you learn what's important to you in terms of how you manage and lead?
And I really hope that this doesn't come off as cliche, but parenting is the experience that for me has been the greatest leadership academy. Our sons are 2 years and 5 days apart, and they are completely different individuals. And so leadership, so Kim and I, who go from partnership to productive adults, have to then figure out what parenting means to us individually. And then we have to figure out how to parent together. And then as these children are born and they have needs, and we have to figure out, okay, so what does it mean to parent the children? And then to recognize, okay, wow, even though they have the same mother and father, but they have different needs and different personalities. And so what does it mean to be the parent to James? And what does it mean to be the parent to John? And what similarities are there, but where are their real differences? And what do they need from me? And what do they need from my wife? And again, in what stage of development? And tuning in to being that responsive and that responsible to children, it has been the greatest boost to my leadership. And by no means do I to patronize anyone that I'm leading, but it is just to recognize the individual needs that someone has. And that part of leadership is to, the trash goes out every Tuesday and Friday, and the trash goes out at the same time, but I have to find one way to motivate the oldest and a different way to motivate the youngest, even though it's the same task, right? And so leadership is, okay, what's going to matter to you and what's going to matter to you? It's figuring out to get homework done. How do you motivate one versus the other? And then when there's limited amount of time, how do we figure out where we spend time as a family and the kinds of activities, and how does that compromise? What does that compromise look like? One of the, I often tell people, my most difficult client engagement ever was working to name the family dog. And literally had to put together a presentation because it told the boys we wouldn't get a dog until they were 8 and 10 because they had to be able to participate in the walking of the dog. And so, we had all kinds of names that everybody wanted to go for, but we couldn't agree. And so the breed of dog that we have is a Basenji. And the Basenji is originally from the Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa. And so they're often known as Africa's barkless dogs. And so literally starting with, so this is where the dog is from, that he's a reddish color. His mother's name was Penny. His father's name was Bourbon. In the 20th century, copper was one of the major exports from the Congo. And Basenjis are really fast dogs. And so you often see the commercials for the copper elbow pads and the knee pads, right, to kind of give you the energy and the boost. And Danielle, I kid you not, I put this whole presentation together to how I was using the characteristic of the breed to come up with a name for the dog. And that's how we ended up naming Copper. But it's just that, right? It's understanding that for John and James and Kim, each of them had different notes that needed to be tuned in, struck, hit, for that name to resonate. And in leadership, it's the same thing, finding out what motivates people. What do people want outside of work? We just hired a new marketing coordinator at Caravella. And I'll ask five questions in the conversation that we had. And the second question that I asked each of the three candidates that I spoke with is, what do you want for your personal development out of your next professional experience? And I shared it with them. I said, because it's great if you come and you knock this particular job out of the park, but if it doesn't fulfill the thing that you want to do and the way you want to grow, it can be a mismatch. And so this idea that Everyone's motivations and outcomes and dreams and passions are different, their sense of their own purpose. And so as you understand that, and then you build a relationship based on those things, even though ultimately we need to get to the same outcome, but we're willing to go along those different paths. But I understand what's going to inspire you. To some folks, I can send a white paper. To other folks, I'll send a video. To some folks, we'll just have a quick conversation and we'll just brainstorm and discuss possibility together. But as you find out how each individual person's spark is lit and you're willing to commit to invest in them in that way, I've found that it helps people fully come to life as they work with you.
That's awesome. It sounds like parenthood has been an excellent training ground for you.
It still is, right? As we make our way through 13 and 15 now, right? Which is the other thing is leadership is never fixed. We never get it right. It's never perfect. We are constantly, again, back to this, for this season, what's needed. And so, yes, I continue to be the idea of the beginner's mind. I continue to bring that even into leadership. I take nothing for granted. So yeah, I'm thankful for that and recognizing that. And again, as I stress, that for me has been really helpful. And I know not everyone is a parent. Not everyone has or chooses that experience. And there are many other ways to develop that leadership skill and build that muscle. But for me, 100% parenting has been that academy.
That's really great. So one final question for you, Brian. You shared a lot of really good lessons here today. If you could go back and tell an earlier version of yourself, anything from where you now sit, what would it be?
Two words. No fear. I remember when I was in elementary school, it was in New York, I was in Queens. We lived in Flushing, Queens, rented a house on Casino Boulevard. There was a Jewish community center that was a couple of houses down, and there was a fence on the sidewalk of the community center. I remember at one point it was that grayish metal, that gunmetal gray, but then they painted it green. And I remember my parents had tried to teach me how to ride a bike, and for whatever reason, it didn't click. And one day I got out on the bike and I just rode and I just tried. And I bring up the Jewish Community Center and the fence because I rode along the fence, falling into the fence. That's so that when I fell, I would fall into the fence. And I know that would be my support. And so as long as I fell into the fence, I'd be able to get back up and keep riding. And earlier in life, I would do more of that. However, as we mature, and there's theoretically more to lose, fear starts to creep in and we stop taking those chances. We start taking smaller bets. We start being willing to forfeit and compromise more on things than we really should. And I would encourage my younger self. And I think up through the period where I think for me, the last really big one was when I forfeited my fellowship. I think that was the last really big one where I went and I forfeited and then I called my parents and I think whatever it is, we'll figure it out from here. And after that, I think for a period of time, I played it safe. And so when I think about going back to my younger self, it would be going back to my 25-year-old self and saying to that 25-year-old Brian, reminding him of what Brian did at seven and what Brian did at kind of 12. And I would remind him of him. That yes, now that we're out of school and yes, we have responsibilities now, but continue to move without fear. And I remember there was Wendell Pierce, the actor. There was a New York Times piece a few years ago. It was talking about his debut in playing Death of a Salesman on Broadway. And he talked about being intimidated for a number of reasons. Right? It's an iconic role. You're doing it on Broadway. First Black actor to ever play this role. And at the end, and so the article opens with him talking about fear, and it ends, Danielle, with him saying, I still have fear, but now I have courage. And that those are the words that I think if I had a way to really distill it, to go back to 25-year-old Brian, I'd borrow those words from Wendell Pierce and say, listen, you can still have fear, you can still have doubts, but have courage.
That's awesome. I think that's some great advice that a lot of us would certainly benefit from. Thank you so much, Brian, for taking the time to connect today and for sharing your story with us. It's an amazing journey, and I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you, Danielle. Thank you so much for reaching out, for being willing to engage in conversation with me. It's been a supreme pleasure, and I'm excited to continue to watch the conversations and the research that you're doing, because again, I really do think we need to normalize these kind of nonlinear paths so that people feel that I'm not where I thought I might be, but that's not failure. as long as you're on your way to where you want to be.
Absolutely.
That's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show and found something to support you wherever you are on your own journey. Don't forget to subscribe where you listen to your podcasts and head over to idtellmyself.com to sign up for updates. Until next time, take care.